Teenage boys rescued after spending more than a month and a half adrift in the South Pacific appear to be in generally good shape, although they are dehydrated and badly sunburned. The boys are from a territory in New Zealand, and one of their relatives, Malu Williams, told AUBC that she's overjoyed they're now safe and sound.
I'm happy. That's why I'm crying. And I need to dance.
The boys were rescued by a tuna fishing boat that spotted them. They told crew members on that vessel that they managed to survive by collecting rainwater to drink and by eating raw fish, coconuts, and a seagull that they managed to catch. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good.
Up next, a recording from the September 27th 4th Annual Hunger Symposium, a production of Illinois Public Media in partnership with the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 4th Annual Hunger Symposium, co-sponsored by the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and Illinois Public Media. I'm Dave Dickey, Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. Our focus this year is childhood hunger. Feeding America reports that 17% of all children under the age of 18 were food insecure between 2005 and 2007. And Kids Count suggests that child poverty rates are expected to rise sharply over the next several years due to the recession. Our hope is tonight's discussion will increase your awareness of the multi-level impacts of childhood hunger and help you to learn what you might do in support of public policy as well as private solutions. We will be examining impacts of hunger on the child, the family, and the community. Our first panelist is Barbara Fees. Dr. Fees has been the director of the Family Resiliency Center since 2008. She earned a PhD in clinical and developmental psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago in 1987. She served as professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Syracuse University, New York from 2000 to 2008, and she held appointments as professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at Upstate Medical University in Syracuse prior to coming to our good old U of I in 2008. She was placed as a visiting fellow by the Advertising Education Foundation at Draft FCB. And that is one of the largest advertising agencies in Chicago, where she studied food advertising and marketing to families. Dr. Fees is a fellow of the American Psychological Association and serves on several national committees and boards. Dr. Fees, thanks for being with us this evening, and an opening question for you this evening. Tonight we will be using three primary terms in our discussion of hunger: food insecurity, hunger, and poverty. Can you give us a brief definition of these terms and explain their relationship to each other?
Boy, I feel like I'm back in graduate school. Okay, I'll try to do my best. Food insecurity is actually a term that's been adopted by the United States Department of Agriculture and the World Health Organization. It's actually a term that refers to an economic condition at the household level where there is uncertain availability and access to variety and adequate and safe foods. So if you are food insecure, it means that you're not able to access either a good variety of food or nutritious food, or at the very, very extreme ends where you're very food insecure, you're not able to have enough food to eat. Food insecurity and hunger are not really the same thing in the eyes of the federal government. Hunger really refers to sort of the physiological feelings that you have when you haven't eaten enough. But if you are food insecure, as a woman reported in a lecture I recently attended, when you got the hungries, I don't think it really matters what the government tells you, whether you're very food insecure or moderately food insecure. But hunger is really the sensation that you feel when you haven't had adequate sources of food. Poverty also has a double-edged sword in terms of its definition. There is the government's definition of poverty. So there is a poverty line that the government draws, and it refers to what you need to live on, according to the government, which really actually originated by the Department of Agriculture, that was determined by how much food you needed to eat multiplied by 3, thinking that the amount of food that you needed to eat was 1/3 of your budget. There are a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me that could tell you how this is calculated. We don't really need to go into it. But the poverty line actually determines whether you are qualified for some government food subsidy programs like SNAP, which we'll probably talk about tonight. But poverty also means that you don't have adequate resources and live in impoverished states. That means that you also live in a state where you don't have adequate sources to food, to transportation. Sometimes you have impoverished school systems. And so that state of life, although the federal government may not recognize it as 100% below the poverty line, that also wears on you over time. So I think we need to talk about the government distinction, but also the lived experience of living in poverty, which is highly related to food insecurity and hunger.
Amy Terpstra is our second panelist this evening. Ms. Terpstra is Associate Director of the Social Impact Research Center at Heartland Alliance. Ms. Terpstra is a data analyst with expertise in Census Bureau, economic and human services data collection, interpretation, and communication. She conducts research for and jointly authors the Social Impact Research Center's annual report on Illinois poverty and leads Impact's Illinois Self-Sufficiency Project. Ms. Terpstra works with stakeholders from all sectors who are seeking data and information to inform their program decisions, service delivery structure, and planning. She recently completed an assessment of child hunger and nutrition programming in Cook County. Ms. Terpstra has an MSW from Jane Addams College of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Ms. Terpstra, thank you for driving down from Chicago this evening, and a question for you. Children represent 25% of the total population in Illinois, but they represent 35% of the total poverty population of the state. Why are children excessively to the population affected by poverty, and what do we know about the link between poverty and child hunger?
All right. Well, thank you for having me tonight. I'm really happy to be here and with all of my other panelists. So to give you a little bit of context about child poverty, as Dave said, children are grossly overrepresented when it comes to being in poverty. And in the state of Illinois, there's about over half a million children who are poor. And when I say poor, I'm referencing what Barb was talking about, the government's official definition of poverty. And to kind of give you a sense of what that threshold is, for a family of four who's poor, their income is below $22,000 a year. So we're talking very, very low income. Dave referenced a study that I lead called the Self-Sufficiency Standard, and basically what that is a look at different communities around the state of Illinois and developing basic family budgets for those families of different types and different geographies. And what that standard shows us is that in Champaign County, a family of four would need about $45,000 to actually make ends meet without assistance, to pay for the things that they need to get by on a daily basis. So to not have to use the food bank, to not get SNAP, to be, as the standard says, self-sufficient. So you can see the huge disconnect there between what the poverty line says, what the government says you are when you're poor, and between what it actually makes, takes to make ends meet. Unfortunately, the latest poverty data that we have for the local levels is outdated. It's from 2008. In about 12 hours, we will have 2009 data. It's going to be released tomorrow. But in Champaign County, as of in 2008, there was about one out of every five children was officially poor. A lot of times when I get questions about poverty in Champaign, people say, well, it's the college kids. They're making they're inflating our poverty rates. But when you really start to dissect it and you look at children who are poor and seniors who are poor, who presumably not going to the university, maybe they are, but you really do get to see, the effects of poverty on the community, and it's cannot just be attributed to your 18 to 24-year-old population. So tomorrow, I think we will see the impact of the recession on poverty of all levels, but in particular children, because children are overrepresented in poverty. And the most simple reason for that, and it sounds so silly, but children can't work. They rely on somebody else to work, and the people that they rely on to work can't work as much once they have kids, right? So your income potential drops once you have a child. I have some stats here looking at some research. Families with a new baby, 13% of those families become poor in the month that the birth occurs, 13%. And for female-headed households, it's even higher. 25% of female-headed households become poor the instant that baby is born. I think we... it goes back to a lot of our policies surrounding work and paid work and in the homework. That came out kind of like homework. But female-headed households in particular are disproportionately poor. And when you start to look at why children are disproportionately poor and you see the rise and increase in female-headed households, it kind of trickles back to why are female-headed households more likely to be poor. And a lot of that has to do with the lower wages that women are paid, the fact that women tend to do a lot more at-home work, work caring, whether it be for their own children or for elderly parents. Taking the link, one of the reasons that I always enjoy coming to this event and to Eastern Illinois Food Bank events is because I get to talk about poverty, because a lot of food banks don't always make that link between the work that they do and the structural causes of the problems that they're trying to address. Hunger and food insecurity are derivatives of poverty. They wouldn't exist if poverty didn't exist. It's logical. The less money you have, the less purchasing power you have, and so you're then less able to afford food in general, period, unless able to afford nutritious quality food that's going to bolster your children's health and social and academic performance, which I think some of the other panelists will touch on. But I really, always like to commend events like this for taking the lens of poverty, because I do really think that it informs our solutions in a different way, and it forces us to think beyond getting food immediately right now into somebody's mouth, which is important, vitally important. That's life-saving, but it also forces us to think bigger and more systemically about what solutions can make it so that that doesn't even happen in the first place.
Social Impact Research Center will have fact sheets on state and local poverty. We encourage you to visit heartlandalliance.org/poverty-report. Our third panelist is Nikki Hillier. Dr. Hillier has worked for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District since 2004. She is a program coordinator in wellness and health promotion and manages and assists with many public health initiatives involving obesity, tobacco, and health hygiene. She is heavily involved in the coordinated approach to Child Health, or CATCH program, is a certified CATCH trainer and has trained schools all over Illinois, including 5 schools in Champaign County. Dr. Hillier also assists with the Farmers Market Program and the Summer Food Program. Dr. Hillier, welcome to you this evening. Question for you. Why is obesity a growing challenge for community organizations like the Public Health District?
I think the biggest challenge is the complexity of it. So, you know, it's not just personal behavior, but there are issues around healthy eating and active living. Like with healthy eating, there are issues like education, access, availability, the flavor of food, all different things around food. But then there's also issues around safe places to play, being physically active, safe places to be, to walk, to commute. So that active living piece is important too. I mean, I think that we've built this environment, or like our society has built an environment that has made it really easy to make an unhealthy choice, almost rewards that behavior. So it's always, you know, 10 cents to get more, and that seems to be the best decision because we're rewarding that because it's cheaper. So I think that since we have created this environment, we really need to create an environment that's going to reward healthy behaviors and make it really easy to make healthy choices, engage in those behaviors. So the issue then is, you know, public health can offer programs, community gardens to empower people to grow their own foods, or, you know, teach people to shop economically for healthy foods and prepare those foods. But we really need to work together. The more that we're finding out about obesity, we're finding more and more barriers. And some of those barriers public health can tackle, and for other times we really need to look to other agencies and build those relationships. So it's a growing challenge because we're finding out more and more about the barriers.
Our fourth panelist is Napoleon Knight. Dr. Knight has served in the role of Medical Director of Hospital Medicine and Associate Medical Director of Carle Foundation Hospital and Carle Physician Group since July of 2010. Within the community, Dr. Knight is a teacher and mentor to many. This includes those students enrolled in the medical field at the University of Illinois, as well as local schools and within the community reaching out to bring awareness and education of proper nutrition, wellness, childhood obesity, and more. Dr. Knight received his MD degree from the University of Minnesota in 1983 and a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Colorado in 1978. He obtained certification as a certified physician executive in 2004. Dr. Knight, thanks for being with us this evening. A question for you. What do we know about the relationship between child food insecurity and health developmental problems?
I'll give you some practical answers, because I think that we have an expert sitting down here at the end of the table. I think that, you know, the issue plays out in many, 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 many ways. And, you know, one of the issues, certainly it affects, you know, childhood development. It affects a child's ability to concentrate. And if you take those two issues alone and you put it in the mix of all the things that we're seeing in our public school system today, it causes immense issues. You know, I have a pretty large family. We had three children of our own, and then my wife said, well, we need more, so we adopted 2 other children, which actually was probably one of the best things I ever did in my life. But that means I've kind of spanned the educational spectrum between a child who's out of college and a child who's still in, you know, the 8th grade. And so I try to avail myself of going to the schools on an ongoing basis to kind of see what's going on. And it's amazing the number of challenges that the teachers have in that environment with all the social issues that are going on. There's issues of parental supervision, there's issues of broken families, and all those issues on top of the issues that play out with children who can't concentrate and children who are hungry and children who, you know, don't have adequate nutrition really makes a learning environment, you know, for those children increasingly, you know, complicated and causes a myriad of other problems along the way.
Our final panelist this evening is Barbara Daly. Ms. Daly is in her fourth year as assistant superintendent at the Regional Office of Education for Champaign and Ford Counties, where she directs the departments of health, life and safety, homelessness, homeschool, truancy, migrant education, and principal solutions. She also acts as ombudsman to 16 school districts. Ms. Daly served as a teacher in Champaign Unit 4 schools for 19 years and as a principal for 12 years. She received a BA in early childhood education, MA in curriculum and instruction, and an advanced certificate in educational organization and leadership from the University of Illinois. Ms. Daly currently serves on the boards of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, Restoration Urban Ministries, and Champaign County Community Action. And she is a member of the Council of Service Providers for the Homeless. Ms. Daly, thanks for being with us. Yeah. An opening question for you. If trends in Illinois follow nationwide projections, child poverty in Illinois can be expected to increase from 17%, that's 535,000 children, in 2008 to 23%, that's over 700,000 children in 2012. Are the schools equipped to handle what promises to be an additional child insecurity load over the next few years? And if not, what is needed?
That is a big question. Let me start by, first of all, thanking Eastern Illinois Food Bank for letting me sit on this panel. I work with these children a lot, and I wanted to say a couple of things first before we get to that about what the impact of food insecurity or insufficiency has on their academics and their success in school. And I think that will frame then the bigger problem of, are we ready for even more? I would say the schools are doing an excellent job. We have seen an increase in wellness programs. We've seen an increase in schools being open in the summer to feed kids. Because often, when we talk about food insufficiency for children, there's a subset of issues that go along with the timing of when they're food insufficient, the depth of it, and also the duration of it. So if you are a student and you're out for the summer, the depth of that food insufficiency could be a lot greater than when you're in school. So I do really want to give a round of applause to schools who do stay open and work for that grant in the summer to feed kids. But among children who are between 5 years old and 12 years old, what we see a lot in the schools, we see poor grades. Obviously, the concentration is impacted through a lot. You know, we see headaches a lot. We see tummy aches a lot. Sometimes there are sleep issues. When you're that hungry, it's hard to sleep. We see not getting along so well with others, because if you've ever gone through a stage where you've been food deprived for a short time, you're grumpy. And it's not always your fault, but you are. We see a lot more grade repetition in students who are food insufficient. And we could also equate that with students in poverty, just like the panelists have said. Lots of absenteeism in the younger grades. We don't see that in the older grades, interestingly enough, because a lot of our older kids who are food insufficient also tend to be unaccompanied youth and can be homeless, and they know coming to school gets them fed. So we see most of the absenteeism in the lower grades. The older kids can handle the hunger and the headache, it seems. We see a lot of anxiety, some aggression, and, of course, difficulty following classroom and school routines if you don't feel good. Among the older teens, what we see and what teachers deal with a lot are depressive disorders. Sometimes we see an increase when you look at the statistics on suicide in older teens. You can almost directly correlate that to some food insufficiency, either a duration of time in their life or a time of poverty. Not always, but it's a good correlation. We see lower grades and more suspensions and rare participation in extracurricular activities. So the question, this is only going to increase, the depth of it and the duration of it. So what we need to do is work with our teachers and our principals on training them about this very issue. Children are going to come to you, and they're going to be amazingly impaired with this food insufficiency. You need to recognize those signs and try to figure out interventions and preventions so that you can head that off and understand what the kids are dealing with. To me, that's number one. You have to have people understand what these kids are going through. The second thing is, how can we feed them at school? That just is so simple. We have the Backpack Buddies program. We run one of those programs out of the ROE for the Rantoul City Schools. Those need to grow. We need to have money to support that. Years ago, we started, this issue first came about, we've always had free lunch. We started having breakfast in schools. The breakfast program now has grown so big, what used to be able to be handled in half of a gymnasium now takes the whole gymnasium. So schools are going to have to be thinking, maybe we ought to feed the kids in classrooms because it's going to grow. It's not going to fit in a gym any longer. These are very practical considerations for schools. And I think they also have to start letting their PTAs know the issue and how it does affect the kids at school. It's that training and education piece. Funding is going to be critical for the schools. And I think the last thing I would like to say about schools handling this issue is the evolving wellness programs that you're seeing in all of the schools. About 5 years ago, we started with just kind of tinkering around with wellness. Now what do you see for fundraising? You see walkathons. You see birthday parties now and school policies that are no longer cupcakes and cookies and soda pop. They'd like you to bring healthy treats. We didn't see this years ago. So I think that with the education, the understanding, the training, the funds to feed them at school, and the community rallying around our schools, I think they'll do just fine. But it really is a community issue.
We'll now spend some time discussing how childhood hunger impacts the child, the family, and the community. Our first focus area is the child, and we'll begin with Dr. Hillier, and we'll ask you this first, and then direct it to anyone else on the panel. Hunger is often difficult to recognize. Are there key indicators that medical professionals, social workers, caregivers, and educators look for when identifying children for nutrition programs and other social services?
At the public health district, what we typically either our programs are open to everyone, or there are certain eligibility requirements that that are required for you to enroll in, say, like WIC. For our summer food programs, because we're sort of situated so close to schools that have high percentages of free and reduced lunch, we can open it up to anybody that's under 18 to come. Our case managers do a screening when they enroll clients in the WIC program, where they assess barriers and resources to food, and if they find that there's gaps, then they sort of switch the counseling from instead of talking about nutrition and healthy foods to where they can get resources and helping connect them with those resources. So there's not necessarily a screening process in terms of the child, but the family in that aspect.
Other responses to the question? I'm sort of thinking in terms of some things that are symptomatic. Overweight children, for example, or maybe symptoms of depression in the mother. Are these some things that are looked at? Dr. Fees?
Well, there are, I think the
Eastern Illinois Food Bank actually does a very good job in training school personnel with the backpack program of different signs to look for in children in school settings. So, you know, you can look at signs for whether children are rushing towards the lunch line and how fast they eat, and different signs along those lines. But this is a very imprecise science at this point. I think the other part of it is that people have some misperceptions or myths about what hunger looks like. We've been involved in an evaluation of the backpack program, and Letitia Washington, who's here today, has been involved in interviewing some school personnel about how you make decisions. And it's a very, very hard thing to make decisions about enrolling children into the program. Some of the literature suggests that sometimes people make decisions based on what they think poverty looks like, and they make decisions about willful neglect of children, which is not really what food insecurity is about. And there's a lot of stigma that goes along with food insecurity and not being able to feed your children. That is probably not based on the circumstances in the family, but it's a misperception about the struggles that people experience when they try to feed their children with limited resources. So there's not a single face of hunger.
I would also like to add that depending on the age of the child, and I would say probably upper elementary, junior high, they're very good at hiding the fact that they're either living in less than ideal circumstances and or hungry. They're very, very good at it. So I agree. There is no face of victim. There's a victim. That's not a very good word of the child. But there's no nothing stands out, and it's very hard sometimes. Mm.
Ms. Daly, I'll stay with you and ask you this. What are the cost burdens for childhood hunger in relation to school?
Well, that's a good question. I think that if you get a lot of children in your population of a school that are suffering from food insufficiency, effects of poverty, then obviously there are more needs there to help those students succeed. And make no mistake that this does not have anything to do with intelligence or how they're going to learn, because all kids can learn, just depends on how we teach them. But you're going to need more staff. I think you're going to need more social workers. You're going to probably need to have more psychological time, because events will occur that will need, these children will need to be scaffolded, and that takes money. The costs, I have no way to really gauge that. I just think they will increase as we try to make sure every student is a success that we have. But those are the areas I think that will increase. And also costs for districts to provide the best food that they can and to help with feeding more kids more of the school day.
If a child is food insecure, are they more likely to be sick? Are they more likely to miss school more often? Are they more likely to do more poorly in school? Are they more susceptible to medical dysfunction and antisocial behavior? Are they more in need of both medical and mental health interventions? I'm seeing a lot of nodding yeses on the panel.
I'll jump in. I think one of the reasons that I like actually love going to events like this is because you always learn something, and I'm really looking forward with bated breath to that information that's coming out, you know, that shows where we've been and where we are. And at least a takeaway from me is that there probably needs to be a lot more education, you know, that goes out to communities and all the people that are involved with children. I mean, sometimes for me, being an emergency doctor, you want to land on something really quick as being the reason. And the takeaway that I have right now is I need to broaden my horizons when I'm looking and talking to some of these people and realizing that there's probably a few more social things going on at home that I need to delve into that might be playing a role in behaviors or difficulty learning or interpersonal relationships with other people.
I'll jump in. Well, I think, first of all, it's important to realize that there's never a single cause for any sort of outcome that you're looking at. So even though we look at things like food insecurity, we know it's wrapped around a lot of other issues. So around poverty, the kind of neighborhood that you live in, a whole host of other things that might be going on. It's also affected by living in a single female-headed household and there are no other adults around. But when you put all those factors together, for very young children, you're much more likely to develop respiratory problems when you're an infant, and your immune function is compromised. So you're more likely to end up in the emergency room. You probably don't have very good health care coverage. When you're in elementary school, has already been brought up, you're much more likely to miss school. In our backpack evaluation, in the first round of our looking at the data, these are all kids who have been determined by school personnel that they could have more use of food over the weekend. The range of days that we saw in those kids missing school was between 1 and 79 days. Now, whether that's way out of the range with the rest of the kids in the school, we don't know yet, but 79 days, that's a lot of days of school to miss. If you look at it nationally, children who live in food insecure households are more likely to have social-emotional problems in terms of worry and anxiety in particular. So if you live in a household where there's a lot of worry and concern about where your next meal is coming from, or if you don't have good nutrients, we talk about headaches, concentration, and sleep. We're learning more and more. I know that Dr. Knight can talk about this. We're learning more and more about the importance of sleep. If you're not getting a good night's sleep, you can't learn. Your brain is probably not growing right. And just having that amount of chaos probably in your household, it's just not good health. So again, it's very, very complicated as an issue. But the one thing is that we are able to identify some of these children in the school setting that maybe would slip through the cracks otherwise.
And, you know, I would also add that, again, getting back to the timing of when the child is going through this, if you're in preschool, first grade, second grade, and the duration of food insufficiency is across those years, it's really hard to recover from some of those effects, according to the research, when you're then 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. You've had some things really happen to you in that amount of time with food insufficiency. The research also shows, though, if the food insufficiency doesn't hit you till 10, 11, recovery is much better. And reading some of those studies is just so eye-opening, how we really have to wrap around our little preschoolers and take care that they're getting everything that they need in our younger kids. It is just that, again, that timing and that duration that is so key to this problem.
You know, in thinking this is making, you guys kind of touched on it a little bit, but I think when we let hunger go unchecked, there's not only the cost at the school and the obvious cost to the children, but when you think about their heightened need for health care then of different varieties, and that immediately leads me to be thinking about the lack of access that many children who suffer from food insecurity and hunger have to quality health care, to doctors that accept the form of insurance that they have, to psychiatrists and psychologists who can treat their mental health problems, to dentists that will accept Medicaid and help them, you know, with sore teeth or pulling teeth, which is also another barrier to concentrating in school. So you begin to kind of see these multiplier effects on the systems level as well as for the child in the different areas of their lives that lead us to, increasingly kind of holistic solutions when we're thinking about these issues.
What are some of the most critical short and long-term health consequences of child food insecurity?
I would say that an interesting thing to consider, and I don't have, you know, data to prove my point. Again, it's anecdotal. I know that there's certainly an issue of, you know, of hunger and poverty, but I know on the other end of the continuum, we have a very significant issue, you know, with pediatric obesity. And I think it's sad but true that for many of these kids, when they do have access to food, the food choices that they make are limited by what they have availability to get. And so when they do have access to something to eat, they're eating pretzels and potato chips and this and that and the other, such that from a long-term health perspective, you know, we're seeing right now, I call it an epidemic, you know, of pediatric obesity with attendant diabetes, hypertension, early coronary disease, early degenerative joint disease, early cardiac dysfunction. It's a real problem that we have to address. So all these things are really kind of interwoven. But I think that in many of these children's neighborhoods where they don't really have access, you know, to appropriate nutrition, it's an overwhelming problem for them.
Dr. Knight, according to a 2009 study from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, 1 in 5 Illinois children is obese. And that puts us as the fourth worst rate in the nation. So the question becomes, what needs to be done to help us understand the causative effect of food insecurity, especially on infants and toddlers versus school-aged children?
I guess, you know, I would go back to, you know, education is key. I mean, I think that we all, you know, need to have a much better understanding of what the issues are. We need to have a much better understanding of the populations that are affected. And then from a community perspective, we really need to ask ourselves, what are we going to do, you know, to start putting some fixes in place? I don't know if you've ever read a book by a guy named Thomas Friedman called The World is Flat. It's either the best or the scariest book that you'll ever read in your life, because it really talks about what's happening, you know, in America. And what's happening in America is, and I say it in a good way, but maybe not, you know, is that our children are not performing well in our schools, and other children across the world are doing better. And such, when all these factors come, you know, to bear, you know, America, from an economic perspective, from a leadership perspective, is falling further and further and further behind. And all of these things are additive, you know, to the problem that you see. And so I think that education is key. I think involvement of people in communities is key. And, you know, the government can't solve everything. We're all going to have to play an active role. I'll just give you another aside, and then I'll let the other panelists speak. You know, from a hospital, you know, perspective, I mean, literally, I mean, we've added special lifting equipment, you know, to take care of our patients in our hospital. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars more for the equipment that we have to buy to take care of our patients. I mean, I took care of a patient not too long ago. It took 9 people, you know, to move the patient, which puts all of our employees at risk. So that's one end of the extreme. But the other end of the extreme is, you know, America is suffering, and if we don't get our hands around this problem, it's going to be a huge problem going forward.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the 4th Annual Hunger Symposium, co-sponsored by the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and Illinois Public Media. Our panelists include Dr. Napoleon Knight, Medical Director of Hospital Medicine and Associate Medical Director of Quality for Carle Foundation Hospital and Carle Physician Group, Amy Terpstra, Data Analyst at Social Impact Research Center, Dr. Barbara Fees, Director of the Family Resiliency Center, Dr. Nikki Hillier, Program Coordinator for the Division of Wellness and Health Promotion at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, and Barbara Daly, Assistant Superintendent at the Regional Office of Education for Champaign and Ford Counties. Our second focus area is the families. And Dr. Fees, I'll address this question to you first, and then to anyone else on the panel. The Illinois Department of Human Services reports that Illinois food stamp cases continue to rise. For the first time ever, More than 780,000 Illinois families are on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, a 11.9% increase over a year ago. What experiences have low and middle income families had during the recession, and how are those experiences different from upper income households?
That's a great question. We all have to make choices in terms of how we prioritize our time and allocate our resources. And the recent recession has really pushed people in terms of thinking about how you allocate your resources. But there are a group of people that have been hit particularly hard. And people who rely on subsidized food programs like SNAP have really, really had to come up with ways to try to manage limited resources. And it's not only economic resources, but you have to understand it's also time resources. And transportation resources. So there was the families who are on SNAP spend more time shopping, preparing food, thinking about food, than other low-income families who aren't on SNAP. Because it takes a lot of time to figure out how are you going to eat on $4.50 a day. For those of you who took the SNAP challenge recently, it's hard. It's not a lot of fun. It's challenging. So when you are engaged in spending all of your energy, your time energy, your emotional energy, you have very little energy left over to do some of those other things that you would like to do, like reading to your child, being engaged in the physical activity that we're all trying to promote as well. And so what you find in, sort of the large national landscape is that a lot of families who are on SNAP are also feeling an incredible amount of stress and strain and being overwhelmed, which does not make for a good, healthy environment. So, at the Family Resiliency Center, we take sort of a whole family approach to all of these big social problems. And so feeding your child, this is like one of the number one things that we all try to do. I mean, it's a way that you protect your children. But if that is such an energy-draining, all-consuming process, then it's hard to do the other things that you really are also driven to do, which is to nurture them. So it is a very time-consuming, and it doesn't look like it's getting a lot better right now.
And I think that's also the problem with some of the programs that we have to offer on healthy eating on a budget or meal planning on a budget. Like Dr. Fee said, people don't have a lot of time to devote to these kind of things. So, websites on tightening your grocery budget and those kinds of things might be helpful for upper middle class people who do have to kind of pinch some pennies now that the economy is in a different place. But for people that are very poor and are really living on that $4.50 a day, offering classes or even garden plots and things like that might not be the solution. It might be more about access to healthy foods, having, if there is a corner store, having fresh fruits and vegetables there, are foods that people can access that are closer to where people who are very, very poor are living.
I would, toss in, and I don't remember the name of the book, but it was kind of amazing. I think it was called The Innovator's Prescription. Anyway, the book is about people doing things differently, and I think that that's really something that we should take away from this. And the story was there was a village, I think it was in Thailand or Vietnam, and there was a researcher there that noted that many of the kids were hungry and starving and having all the issues that we're talking about right now, but there were a few children in the village who were doing well, who looked healthy, and they were living in the same village. And the guy was kind of perplexed, and he said, well, I don't understand this. They're living in the same village. They have access to the same things. Why are they doing well, and why are they aren't doing well? And so what he actually did is he went and he talked to the mom and said, well, what are you doing that other people aren't doing? And, you know, she was finding little, you know, shrimp in the water and giving the kids a source of protein, and she was finding vegetables that other people were overlooking. The point of the story is I think that we have to find ways to help people get the information that they need and help them see that even though times are kind of tough and people are struggling, that, you know, hopefully with a little bit of additional help, resources, and some people demonstrating how you can do things, you know, that other people might benefit. And what they did is they replicated this model not only in that village but in several other villages around the world, and actually they really have improved nutrition for some of these children.
For anyone on the panel, has the recession changed the profile of hunger in any significant way?
I'll take a stab at that. I think yes. And I'm going to go back a little bit to another job I have, and that's working with public school students and their families who are experiencing homelessness. And as we look at the face of hunger, the face of poverty, why food stamps continue to rise, how it affects low middle class, I'd like to use an example. My first year at the regional office, I took over a program for homeless public school students, and we had 120 kids on our database who were verified homeless by their schools. Second year, we got up to almost 200 kids, and that would have been 2008. And as we started talking to the families on why they had lost their homes, it became apparent as we looked at the demographics, the first year, a lot of the kids that we were seeing were from just generations of poverty, of kids that families that had not really been stable in their housing for a very, very, very long time through many generations. The second year, what we saw in growth were these lower middle class families where mom might have been a beautician in her home and dad might be a mechanic at Walmart. Well, when the job loss hit, people weren't getting their hair done anymore. Walmart doesn't need four mechanics, it needs three. Now we're homeless. So the face changed a little bit. Now we've got people who have never, ever had to deal with this and deal with poverty and the resulting hunger that they faced. Third year, we got up to almost 320. What happened then? What we started to see were whole apartment complexes being foreclosed, and people that were hanging on in 2008, they pay their rent, they pay their utilities, landlord doesn't, boom, the whole thing shuts down. They can't reestablish, they can't rehouse. Last year for 2009, we ended the year in June, well actually 09-10 school year, we ended the year with 425 on our rolls. So we're putting in rehousing efforts, emergency services efforts, food through the backpack program, food through food mobiles. This is the population, folks, that need jobs, and they need training for jobs that are out there. And to me, jobs is the answer to a lot of this. I mean, obviously, education, everything. But they don't have anywhere to turn unless we provide jobs and education. So until this economy turns around, I think we have a huge challenge ahead of us.
And I think, you know, an interesting kind of add-on to what you're saying about the, you know, people moving into poverty and experiencing hunger who have never experienced it before, I think there's really something, you know, we can really see the role that assets play in a family's life, and when families don't have assets. Mm-hmm. How quickly that slide happens for them. In Champaign County, a full third of households are asset poor. And what that means is that you don't have enough money saved up to subsist at the poverty level for 3 months. So we learned that the poverty level is really, really low to begin with. So it's not, that's not a very high threshold at all. And a full third of families here are asset poor. And so I think that that really makes us think a little bit differently about solutions, not only on the income end of things, but how to promote that savings and really give people that nest egg to fall back on in hard times.
You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.
Ms. Terpstra, 52% of Illinois children are now eligible for free and reduced price.